case number 13-7038, Patricia Grimes, as the next best friend and personal representative of the estate of Carl Grimes, appellant, the District of Columbia. Mr. Latimer for the appellant, Ms. Wilson for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. Again, my name is Greg Latimer, and I represent the mother of the decedent, Carl Grimes. This is the second time this matter has been here. This court remanded this case.
And let me ask you about that. The first time it was here, did you brief the motion to strike issue?
Yes, sir.
And the court just did not address that?
The court did not address that. The court at that time simply remanded the matter to have the trial.
I knew that, but I didn't know if you all had raised the issue there. But,
yes, okay. That issue was raised at that time. All the issues that are raised now were raised before. Mm-hmm. With respect to the remand, the trial court was given specific instructions by this court in what it ought to do. Instead of doing that, the trial court simply went back to the district's motion and decided that because it was conceded that it could grant the motion. And in fact, the trial court somewhat incredulously says in its opinion, the court is satisfied that defendant's record citations support its assertions regarding the absence of a genuine dispute as to any material fact as to plaintiff's Eighth Amendment claim. And there are only three record citations that the defendant cited, all of which were from plaintiff's complaint.
Let's focus on that, though, Mr. Latimer. Your client has the burden of proof on the elements, and if we read Celotex to permit a motion for summary judgment that essentially identifies gaps in the plaintiff's proof such that no reasonable jury could find for the plaintiff on the evidence that the plaintiff has proffered, are you arguing that is not a proper motion under Rule 56C?
If that were the case, but in this case, if you take the three paragraphs or the three items that you take from plaintiff's complaint and say that provides the basis for summary judgment, well, you can't ignore the rest of the complaint. Because if you take the remaining paragraphs of plaintiff's complaint, then clearly a Eighth Amendment violation is set forth, a negligent supervision is set forth.
Yes, but under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, when we've progressed past the motion to dismiss stage and are at the motion for summary judgment stage, we're no longer testing the allegations of the complaint. And I understand that you're saying, well, but they referred to the complaint. But they're referring to the complaint, as I read it, as a way of identifying the elements of what the plaintiff is setting out to bring to a jury, and then using that in effect as an outline or a template for what evidence would be required. And the court didn't have to refer to the complaint for that. It could have just referred to case law and said, well, on an Eighth Amendment claim, one would need to come forward with a triable issue on a proffer of fact that would take this issue, you know, each of the necessary elements to the jury. So one way of reading, and I think the correct way of reading what the district court did, was say, I don't see the evidence here.
Well, the evidence wasn't there because the district court doesn't put in place a scheduling order.
Well, no, but there was, I have a question about that too. There was a scheduling order originally.
There was.
Is it not the duty of counsel when there's a scheduling order in place to assume, unless and until that scheduling order is changed, that that is the governing order? You can't assume that the court's going to grant you anything unless it's been granted. So there was a pending motion, but you've got to operate on the situation as the court set it up until you hear otherwise. No?
Well, that puts the plaintiff in a serious predicament because there's a motion for protective order.
Yeah, but on June 21st, the district court gives you until July 30th to do discovery, and you did nothing. You sat there for a month. Nothing. Had some phone calls with opposing counsel, but why didn't you take discovery in the month that you were given at the end of June and July?
Well, we did try to take discovery during that period, but the discovery, what we were trying to do was get in place what we could do with the defendant. It takes two to tango. And what we had agreed to do was to address this issue with the court because the scheduling order that was in place had even our extensions were expired in terms of the scheduling order. We did not have in place anything that we could do under the scheduling order that would still be in place once the court had not ruled upon either the
motion.
That's
not my understanding of what happened, but maybe I thought that on June 21st, 2010, the district court granted the motion for extension that you had sought before, and that you had until the end of July to take discovery.
No,
that's not a great deal of time, but it's time in which you took no discovery.
No, the district court granted the motion to extend the discovery period, but all of the period that we had asked for had already expired by that time.
I don't think that's right, but anyway.
Not the way we read the record. Yeah. I mean, the court acted on the motion on June 21st, 2010, and set a new deadline of July 29th, 2010. And so much of the time had elapsed, but there was still, even under your theory, which is that you couldn't do anything until there was a new scheduling order, which I don't know if there's any, I don't know any authority for that. But even under that theory, there was clearly time from June 21st to July 29th. So one question is, what about from February to June? And then the further, even clearer, more pointed question is, what about from June to July?
At that time, the only issue that really needed to be addressed at that point was the expert. And the expert designation time had expired. That was the reason why it was an agreement. There was an agreement with the defendant that we were going to seek additional time. Instead of them doing that, they filed a motion.
Did you not, and I'm not sure I'm remembering this correctly, but I thought that you had briefed that you would need depositions before you could submit an expert report?
The expert had indicated that he would like to have those, but, I mean, we would like to have had those, but it wasn't.
But those were not noticed. There were no depositions noticed at any time?
When the deposition was noticed, they filed for a protective order, so there had been no other ones noticed. That's correct.
But why didn't you, in response to the motion for summary judgment, why didn't you file a response to that identified fact issues that were to be resolved? Instead, you filed a motion to strike based on disqualification.
Right.
That's a pretty risky strategy, isn't it? If that gets denied, what happens to summary judgment?
Well, I think under the law, what should have happened here is if the court was going to deny that motion, if the court was going to say that motion had no merit, then the court had an obligation to deny that motion and then grant a period for us to then respond.
Where do you find that obligation?
Yeah,
that's not the way I read it.
Well, that was my understanding of what the rule would be.
So my understanding of Rule 56 is that it's actually quite demanding of a party in your client's situation. If you receive a summary judgment motion and you don't have in hand the material that you need to use to oppose the motion for summary judgment, you have an obligation under Rule 56D to file an attorney affidavit, and there are some pretty detailed and stringent requirements in our circuit about what that attorney affidavit has to say to seek with the court an opportunity to put in any additional information, to obtain and to put in any additional information that's not already in the record. And there was no 56D affidavit in this case that I've seen.
We did do that in the motion to alter or amend.
You did not. You put in a declaration that was very cursory and that did not begin to respond to this circuit's requirements for a Rule 56D affidavit.
Well, I was of the impression that when we did put it in, that would be sufficient because it fully set forth what exactly was needed, what we needed to do, why we were seeking the information that we were seeking, and the basis for us seeking the information that we were seeking. Now, I'm not aware that the rule requires additional factors, but if that was inadequate, again, I don't believe that the route to take was to grant a motion that had absolutely no undisputed material facts set forth. I mean, when you're moving, the movement also has an obligation. And
you
in
know,
this case,
Celotex really limited Atticus. The rule you're talking about sounds like an Atticus versus Kress idea, where the moving party, if it's the defendant who doesn't have the burden of proof, has to come forward and negate the existence of the facts on which plaintiff purports to rely. That is not the burden under Celotex. Under Celotex, the Supreme Court has said that the defendant can point to gaps in the plaintiff's case, does not need to support that motion with evidence, but just point to gaps. So it does put a burden on you and on your client, and I don't see how you could have put all your eggs in that motion to strike basket without any alternative argument about if you don't accept that motion to strike or if you find that Nichols needs to be stricken but the remedy is not to set the entire summary judgment motion aside. There's some summary judgment merits there, and that was not briefed.
But when you cite to the record, and these are the gaps that you're pointing out in their plaintiff's complaint, and if this is the way the pendulum is swinging, that you're going to say we can accept one portion of plaintiff's complaint to show the gaps, but then we ignore the rest of the plaintiff's complaint where the plaintiff fills in those gaps. And I don't think that would be fair to the plaintiff.
Take a minute and give us your argument on the motion to strike, why it wasn't moot.
Well, it wasn't moot at the time. I mean, once you grant the motion for summary judgment and the case has been dismissed, of course it's moot at that point. But it's not moot at the time that it was filed. At the time that it was filed.
Why was it not moot?
Because the motion to strike dealt exactly with the motion. We were saying at that point that this motion has been filed by counsel who should not have been filing this motion based upon the circumstances here. This is a lawyer who had represented specifically this individual. This individual was one of the primary plaintiffs in the Jerry M. case because this is an individual who had died. And so this would have been...
Is your argument... the district court judge has before him a motion for summary judgment and then a motion to strike based on disqualification, and he rules on the motion for summary judgment.
Correct.
And then says, well, that has now mooted out the motion to strike for disqualification. What's wrong with approaching... Doesn't that seem like a perfectly efficient way to deal with the case?
Well, I don't think that you can rule on the motion when the motion itself, you're moving to strike the motion. They're not separate things. The motion to strike is filed in response to the motion being filed. And so what the trial court did was say, I'm not going to rule on the motion to strike. I'm going to rule on the underlying motion. I'm going to grant that motion.
Doesn't he have that sort of discretion to do that? Or
I don't think that you have the discretion when the party is saying that a motion is improperly filed, and that motion should be stricken as a matter of law. And this is the basis why it should. And instead of the court addressing that point, the court rules on the motion that you're attacking as an improperly filed motion, and then allows that ruling to
agree. If we were to agree with you that the motion was not moot, that he should have taken up the motion to strike, what happens then? How does the case proceed from there?
Well, what we had indicated previously and now is that if the court rules that the motion is with merit, then obviously the motion is
so go back to the district court. He rules on the motion to strike.
Right. And if the motion rules, if the trial court rules that the motion is without merit, then the court enters that ruling, and then he designates.
Then we're back to summary judgment again.
Right. You have to file your opposition within whatever time limit he determines is appropriate.
Mr. Latimer, do you have the authority for the notion that were the court to find that Mr. Nichols should have been disqualified, that the remedy in the posture in which this case was presented to the district judge, the remedy would be to strike the summary judgment motion? It seems to me that that's a separate question. If Mr. Nichols should have been disqualified, then there's a separate remedial question. What flows from that? You know, maybe the district court should have had an evidentiary hearing on was he in fact involved? Could that motion be refiled without his name on it? You know, you've assumed in styling the motion as a motion to strike that there's an identity between disqualification and elimination of that pending motion. I'm just not sure that I see any legal authority for that.
Well, I think that the rules of professional conduct indicate that if you take it to the law firm, if there's one member of your law firm that is disqualified from representation, then the entire law firm is.
Specifically, that rule of imputed disqualification doesn't apply to government agencies.
So. Well, we're not saying that the remedy ought to be X or the remedy ought to be Y. What we're saying is that the court had an obligation to rule on that motion. We believe that that's what the remedy is, but I'm not saying that
you're saying that's the argument you want to make before the district court.
Right. But I'm not saying that how it should have come out ultimately, but it should have been addressed. And that was all we were saying.
I think you've actually conceded a pretty significant point just there when you say we're not saying what the remedy ought to be or how it ought to come out. We're just saying the district court ought to have ruled. Unless the remedy must be the elimination of that pending motion, then there's no error in what the district court did. Because if the district court says, well, whatever happens on the disqualification motion, there's no merits opposition to the summary judgment, and therefore this case is over anyway, then
I think you misunderstood what I said. What I said was I'm not saying that the district court necessarily had to take a position that the entire office was disqualified, that the entire office was not allowed to represent in this case because of his association. But we are saying that he was disqualified. That motion that was filed with his name on it could not be a motion that went forward. And so when I say that I'm not saying what the remedy ought to be, there are some things that we are saying ought to have happened, but I'm not taking it so far as to say, as I gave the example of the law firm, and whether or not the entire office or someone else in that office would have been necessarily disqualified. But certainly he should have been, and any document that he filed, that was filed with his name on it, should not have been a part of the record.
Mr. Latimer, you had an expert identified in your own office. Why, in response to the motion for summary judgment, did you not identify that expert in your attorney declaration, even on the motion to alter or amend the judgment under Rule 59?
To be honest with the court, I had a case in the D.C. Court of Appeals where another lawyer had failed, had identified his expert, but had not signed the actual paperwork for the expert to testify, and the Court of Appeals took issue with that. In this case, we had retained the expert to evaluate the evidence, but we had not retained him for trial. And so I was being a little bit cautious in that regard because of the decision by the D.C. Court of Appeals several years ago.
I ask you, are you assuming that what you put in a complaint can satisfy the burden of proof of the party with that burden in response to a summary judgment?
Well, I'm not.
Do you think that that is a sufficient showing? In other words, the Rule 56, has specific requirements as to how you meet your burden of proof if you carry it. I was not aware that the complaint did it.
Well,
is that your argument?
What we're saying is that the court is
wrong. No, I understand what you're saying about the court referring to something in the complaint. That's not my question. Do you think you can satisfy your burden of proof if you carry it by referring to what you assert in a complaint? You can't do that.
Well, in actuality, what one of the things I looked at was that it says, in order to, when you're assessing the motion for summary judgment, the court is obligated to look at all of the pleadings.
This is a really tight question.
My honest opinion is, Your Honor, to be frank with the court, I do not believe that a party can stand on a complaint alone as the basis for.
When you get to summary judgment, you're out of proof. submitting stage.
Right, but I don't believe...
You've got to submit an affidavit, a deposition. They're listed in the rule, and you have to come forth if the burden's on you, and I think that's what my colleagues have been suggesting to you is, whatever the district court referred to, the truth of it is, there was nothing there. And the district court said, essentially, you lose because you haven't supported your claim in response to a motion for summary judgment, and the other side doesn't carry the burden of proof. And the other side can simply say, he hadn't offered anything, I win. And that's what the Supreme Court has said, yeah. The district court has a little more leeway now under the rule, but the district court, in the end of the day, the district court can say, complaining party hasn't submitted anything, you lose.
And what we said was that the reason that we don't have this is because you don't put a scheduling order in place. Well, and
it comes down to whether or not there's any validity to your claim that you were somehow treated unfairly in the scheduling orders.
In terms of that issue, yes, sir.
Because otherwise you don't have anything.
Well, I think that when, again, I understand what the court is saying, and generally I agree with that. But I don't think it's fair to allow the other side to rely upon plaintiff's complaint.
No, the other side doesn't have to rely on anything. The other side has no burden.
I understand that. But
make sure you understand what we would be thinking. The other side at bottom is simply saying, you haven't put anything in, we should win.
And the only reference to your complaint is to say what you had at the outset of the case said you wanted to prove. And so, I mean, they could have relied on case law or just their understanding of the case, but it's a little bit more precise to say, well, this is what, you know, the promise at the beginning of the case based on the complaint was that this is what these people were trying to prove, and we don't see it. So it's not relying on it in any sense except as definition of what you chose to set out on this case to prove. Let me ask you one more question about the way that this all got decided by the district court. Is it your position that the motion for disqualification of counsel, that the district court was legally required to decide that before ruling on the merits of the summary judgment? Where is that in your briefing in the district court and or here?
Well, that was raised in the motion to alter or amend. That was raised in our previous briefing before this court. That was raised in our briefing here.
It would be helpful to have precise identification because I don't see that argument made. And there's no authority cited for that point, but it does seem like it's a potentially significant legal question. Maybe that's something you could bring up on rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from the District of Columbia now.
Good morning, and if it pleases the court, I'm Mary Wilson representing the District of Columbia. The court's questioning has highlighted many of the points we wanted to make as to why the district court did properly grant summary judgment to the district in this case. This case is just like Celotex, where the district asserted that plaintiff had no evidence with which to prove her case, and the plaintiff never came back and rebutted that with any evidence to prove the elements of her claim. And for that reason, the district court did properly exercise its broad discretion to treat that assertion as undisputed. And then it flowed from that.
Treat what assertion as undisputed? There were only three facts that the district listed as being undisputed, and yet the district court went beyond that filing to look to arguments made in the brief.
There were only three facts in our statement of material facts, but the body of the motion said over and over again, plaintiff has no record evidence of deliberate indifference, of Monell liability, and has no expert. So the assertion in the, and that's Celotex. We don't have to disprove.
So that's the concession you're referring
to. That's the concession, that the body of the motion said plaintiff had no evidence, and it was her burden to come back and show that there was a reason to go to trial.
It's Celotex, although it's a little closer to what the advisory committee seemed to be talking about in the note to 56E that troubled our predecessor panel. And that advisory committee note says summary judgment cannot be granted by default, even if there is a complete failure to respond to the motion, much less when an attempted response fails to comply with Rule 56C requirements. Now, why isn't this case still troubling under that advisory committee note and under that portion of Rule 56E? It seems like what we have here is precisely a grant by default, presentation of no evidence, or an attempted response that fails to comply with Rule 56C.
Well, the court in the first appeal remanded for the district court to state its reasoning. And the district court did that this time, indicating it was not simply granting it as conceded. The factual assertions, yes, the plaintiff had the burden to come forward and say, we have some evidence that justifies going to trial. But if they don't come back with that, then as a matter of law, the district court then said, well, the district is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Not that the entire motion was conceded, but that as a matter of law, the district was entitled to judgment because plaintiff had not shown she had any evidence with which to go to trial. So it wasn't just, you know, one sentence, the motion is granted as conceded. It was several pages of going through the allegations, establishing that plaintiff had not responded to the assertion that she had no evidence. So the evidentiary portion of it was conceded, but not the underlying entitlement to judgment as a matter of law.
Can you speak to the appearance on the papers in this case of Mr. Nichols? It just is a little bit startling that was done. And I mean, there were proceedings in the District of Columbia courts, apparently, on conflict questions. And I mean,
yes. First, the issue is moot prospectively because Mr. Nichols is no longer in the office.
I understand.
Two, as the court already discussed, the remedy would be to remove Mr. Nichols' name from the signature block. The remedy would not be to strike the district court.
Well, that's assuming a lot of facts that weren't before the district court about his level of involvement or not. I mean, you've briefed that issue, but there's nothing in the nature of declarations. I mean, I'm a little surprised at that. There's no factual material proffered in response to the motion to strike by the district, you know, attesting to what role or not he had. It's just briefing.
Well, the body of our opposition to the motion to strike did say that his only involvement in the case was his name on the signature.
In a brief. There's nothing factual on that, which
is... Well, and that assertion was undisputed, that he...
Well, it was never put in issue factually. It was argued in a brief.
Yes, and plaintiff never came back and said...
I would
one,
think
that there was no...
I would think the district would want to take really quite special care to... To make a record on that and to do it rigorously with... I don't think it's plaintiff's burden on that. I think it's the District of Columbia's burden, and as officers of the court, you know, your burden. It's not about the plaintiff's in this instance, I don't think, burden. I mean, it was identified quite late by the plaintiffs, but your office presumably knew about it in the end of 2009, at least. It was publicly discussed a year before.
Yes. It was raised late in this case because Mr. Nichols' name was on our answer. But it was the district's position that the two cases were not substantially related so as to require Mr. Nichols' recusal from it. You know, one case was a class action dealing with injunctive relief. This was a case, a wrongful death case for damages. There was no allegation as is... I mean, the purpose of the Rule 1.9 is to keep a lawyer from using confidential information gained from a client to use against that client. There's no allegation that Mr. Nichols gained confidential information in his representation of Darium. That was not already known.
That's the purpose of the rule. Does the court need to go through that level of inquiry to find out?
Well, the Brown...
Isn't there another purpose of the rule, and that's to avoid the appearance of impropriety?
Yes, and... We understand the court's concern that a quick review thinks both of these cases involved conditions at Oak Hill.
Yeah, my concern is why wasn't this argument being made at the district court level? Why wasn't evidence proffered before the district court? Why isn't this hashed out there in the district court? Why didn't the district court look at this and resolve the issue to see, in fact, whether there was a real conflict? I mean, there's certainly a conflict when it comes to a matter of appearance. There's no question about that. But you're arguing, but there was no conflict in reality. Well, why isn't that being argued in front of the district court with evidence proffered by both sides so that it gets resolved there?
The district court had broad discretion to manage its docket and to decide the motions in front of it. There was an unopposed motion for summary judgment. The district had even filed a motion.
But in the reality of it, there was a motion for summary judgment, and then Ms. Grimes' counsel says, wait a second, Mr. Nichols is involved in this, and that's an improper motion. He should not be involved in this case. Stop the proceedings, and let's resolve this issue. And the district court disregarded that. District court decided for whatever reason, no, we can go ahead and decide the motion for summary judgment with this cloud hanging over the propriety of the district's filings. Why isn't that a reasonable way to approach what was going on?
It would have been a reasonable alternative approach. But what the district court did was within the range of permissible alternatives with different pending motions. The motion to strike did not operate as a stay.
Am I right? I thought the only thing the district court said about the motion to strike was that it was moot. Am I wrong?
Originally it said it was moot. It
said nothing about it on round two.
Yes, whether it was moot.
So the only thing that we have before us as to the district court's thinking about this motion to strike was that it was moot. There's none of this discussion that we're having right now about whether there was an actual conflict or not.
And you think that's within the record, we don't know if the district court.
And you think that's within the discretion of the district court when
yes.
to decide whether.
See, that's a stretch under 56E. It is true that 56E, in the face of situations like this, gives the district court some discretion. But among the things that the district court is supposed to consider is issue any appropriate order, which in my mind would be, well, I've got a motion to strike here. I have to address that first because there's at least an appearance of impropriety and get that off the books if I'm thinking about going ahead and exercising my discretion to grant the summary judgment. That's where you're in the trap. You have no answer because all you can say is, well, I didn't do it. The district court did it. But there really isn't an answer on this record as to what in heaven's name the district court was thinking about in not addressing the motion to strike. It's there. It's not moot. That is a stretch of mootness. It's not moot. It is there to be. The implicit, if not explicit, claim is you can't decide this case on the merits if an attorney is representing the other side and ought not be representing the other side.
Mm-hmm. On the original record, the district court did say the motion is moot. On the remand record,
Said nothing.
So
that's where we're left.
Yes, but we cite extensive authority in our brief that a court can, if there's a motion to strike pending and a substantive motion, that the court has discretion to look at the substantive motion and tacitly deny the motion to strike. And
which case did you mention?
This is under 50, the interpretation of the revised rule.
I have a footnote about tacit denial of motions to strike. That you can go on to look at the.
But not a motion to, if I'm remembering correctly, not motions to strike on disqualification, attorney disqualification grounds. I don't think. Yeah.
Well, because that is true, and that makes all the difference in the world, doesn't it?
But here.
That's our case.
It's plain that the motion.
Give me some authority that a district court judge has discretion to disregard a motion to strike based on disqualification and then proceed to summary judgment.
Or any motion for disqualification, no matter how styled.
Right.
I mean,
there is none.
I don't have that authority.
Yeah, you don't have any because there is none.
But this court can interpret the record that there was no reason to strike the motion for summary judgment.
We don't have a record.
No,
we don't have a record. We don't have a
remedy.
If we were the Supreme Court, we'd do anything we wanted to do, but we're not.
Under Rule 1.10,
5060 is what we're looking at, and whether or not the district court abused its discretion in picking the among the options in 5060. And yes, the district court has discretion in the 5060, but in my mind, I can't understand why a district court wouldn't have first said, there's a pending motion to strike, I reject it, and explain why, and then go to the merits. That didn't happen here.
That would have been easier at this point.
That's right, and that's why you're frustrated, and I can understand. I would be frustrated in your place, too, but nonetheless, that's the record before.
But I think this court can nevertheless affirm. First, there was no reason to strike the line attorney who signed the summary judgment motion, because 1.10, disqualification of one government attorney does not disqualify the entire firm. So there was no reason to strike the motion for summary judgment.
It doesn't necessarily. I mean, you need to find facts. You need to find out what was done. What was the nature of the representation? What did Mr. Nichols do? What was his involvement?
And it was reasonable to infer that he received no confidential information that could have been used against the decedent in this case. But under the totality of the facts here and the total circumstances of this case, there is no reason to remand for the district court to address that motion. The plaintiff had extensive information before he ever filed this case about the circumstances of the decedent's death. He had the medical reports, the police reports, the DYRS reports, and the youth reports for all the children involved in the fight. The district gave him 1,800 more pages in discovery, answered his interrogatories. He never, despite the scheduling order in place, he never sought more discovery, never sought depositions, if he in fact needed more discovery. Despite all that information, he has never even acknowledged the district's position that he has no evidence to prove his constitutional claim. He has repeatedly said the only basis for our motion was his lack of an expert. He's never come forth and said how he would prove his Eighth Amendment and Monell claims at trial. No opposition to the summary judgment motion, no opposition to the motion to treat summary judgment as conceded. His Rule 59 motion and the reply and his appellate briefs on two appeals have never proffered any evidence justifying remanding or taking this case to trial.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Latimer, we'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. Give you back 2 minutes.
Well, the first thing I'd like to do is respond to Judge Pillard's request that I point out where in the record in our motion.
Thank you. I'd love to hear my name properly pronounced. It's about 1 in 10 that does that.
On the record at page 195, Joint Appendix at 195, which is the motion to alter or amend, even though the court denied the motion to strike and to disqualify as moot, it nonetheless granted a motion filed by Mr. Nichols and his office to treat the motion for summary judgment as conceded, which was filed after the motion to strike and disqualify was filed. Clearly, this was inappropriate, and at the very least, the court should have given the plaintiff a date certain to otherwise respond to the motion for summary judgment if it was going to deny the motion to strike and to disqualify. That was in the motion to alter or amend. In our brief on page 14, we addressed the same point in our reply at page 12. We addressed the same point. And in our reply brief, when the matter was here before, in appeal number 11-7053, we addressed the same point on page 10. So in every opportunity we've had, we've brought this issue before the trial court. We brought the issue before this court. Before, we brought the issue to this court now. And it is our position, it always has been our position, that we thought the motion was a serious motion, that when you have this situation, that it was something that the district court should have addressed. If it wasn't going to address it, which it didn't, it should have at least told us that. And even if it gave us one day to respond to the motion, They should have done that.
Notice your red light is on. Do either of my colleagues have any questions? We have your argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted.